letting me a room for my stays in Turin. I loaded other boxes of my things into the car and took them to my mother's place in Milan. From the motorway, Monte Rosa emerged above the haze like a mirage. In the city, the heat was melting the asphalt, and it seemed to me that I was pointlessly shifting stuff from one place to another, going up and down stairs of apartment buildings, expiating who knows what sin that I'd committed in the past. My mother was in Grana during this period, so I spent more than a month alone in the old apartment, by day doing the rounds of the offices of the producers I was working with, and at night watching the traffic from the window, imagining the anemic river buried beneath the avenue. There was nothing that belonged to me, nothing that I felt I belonged to. I was trying to get into production a series of documentaries on the Himalayas that would keep me away for a long time. It took a lot of fruitless meetings before finding someone who had faith in me. In the end, I secured funding that would cover the cost of travel and not much else. But for me, it was enough. When I went back up to Grana in September, there was a cold air blowing and a few chimneys in the village were smoking. Once out of the car, I noticed a smell on my body that I did not like. So at the beginning of the path, I washed my face and neck in the river, and in the woods rubbed my hands with a green larch twig. These were my usual rituals, but I knew that it would take a few days to be properly clean of the city. All along the deep valley, the pastures were beginning to fade. On Bruno's land, beyond the bridge of planks, the bank of the river was all trampled by the hooves of the herd. From there upwards, the grass was finished, closely shaved and already fertilized. And there were patches of earth where the odd cow would scrape on days of bad weather, unsettled by the smell of a thunderstorm. I could smell a storm in the air right now, together with the pungent odor of dung and of wood smoke rising from Bruno's home. This was the time when he would be making the cheese, so I decided to head straight on and come down to find him on another occasion. Having passed the stable, I heard the cowbells and saw Lara pasturing the herd high up, far from the path, on slopes where the last grass remained. I waved to her, and having already caught sight of me, she waved back with her unopened umbrella. The first drops of rain were beginning to fall, and after all those nights made restless by the heat and by dreams, I felt overcome by exhaustion. I just wanted to get to Barma, light the stove, and sleep. There was nothing like a long sleep in my burrow inside the mountain to put me right again. There followed 3 days of fog, during which I hardly left the house. I would stay at the window, observing the way in which the clouds rose up from the valley and insinuated themselves into the woods, passing between the branches of the larch and fading the colors of my prayer flags before swallowing them completely. In the house, the low pressure extinguished the fire in the stove, smoking me as I read or wrote. Then I would go out into the fog and stretch my legs by walking to the lake. There I would throw a stone that would vanish even before producing its phantom thud, and I imagined schools of small curious fish swimming around it. In the evening I would listen to some Swiss radio station or other, thinking about the year that was in store for me. It was a period of incubation, of the kind appropriate before great exploits. On the third day there was a knock at the door. It was Bruno. He said, "So it's true that you're back. Want to come to the mountain?" "Now?" I asked, since everything was shrouded in fog outside. "Come on, I'll show you something."
"And the cows?"
"Let the cows be. It won't kill them." And so we set off climbing back up the slope, along the path that led to the higher lake. Bruno was wearing his rubber boots, filthy with dung up to his thighs, and as we walked he told me that he had been into the slurry pit to pull out a cow that had fallen into it in the fog. He laughed. He was going up in a rush, so quickly that I was struggling to keep up. A viper had bitten one of the dogs, he said. He realized because he saw him next to water all the time, constantly thirsty, and checking him over had found the puncture marks made by the viper in his swollen belly. He was dragging himself around pitifully, and Lara was ready to put him on the mule and take him to the vet, when Bruno's mother had said to give him as much milk as he would drink, just milk and no water or food. And now he had recovered and was gradually regaining his strength.
"With animals, there is always something new to learn," he said.
He shook his head and resumed climbing with that pace of his that nearly did for me.
All the way up to the lake, he continued talking about cows, milk, manure, grass, because during my absence so many things had happened that I needed to be informed about. He was thinking of bringing some rabbits and chickens up sometime in the future, but he needed to build some good fences because there were foxes about. Eagles, too. You might not believe it, but the eagle is even more ferocious than the fox when it comes to farmyard animals. He didn't ask me how I had got on in Turin or in Milan. He wasn't interested in anything I might have been up to during the course of a whole month. He talked about foxes and eagles and rabbits and chickens, and pretended, as usual, that the city didn't exist, and that I didn't have another life elsewhere. Our friendship existed there, on that mountain, and what happened down below should not even be mentioned. "And the business? How's that going?" I asked, as we got our breath back at the small lake. Bruno shrugged his shoulders. "Well," he said, "are the sums adding up?" He grimaced. He looked at me as if I had asked an annoying question just for the pleasure of ruining his day. Then he said, "I leave the accounts to Lara. I've tried doing them myself, but I guess I'm no good at it." We climbed up the scree in thick fog, with no path, each of us finding his own way. We couldn't see well enough to follow the cairns, losing sight of them almost immediately, in fact, and letting ourselves be guided by the incline, our instincts, the lines suggested by the scree itself. We were climbing up blind, and every so often I heard the sound of stones that Bruno had dislodged above or below me, made out his outline and headed straight towards it. If we got too far from each other, one of us would call out, "Oh!" and the other would respond with, "Oh!" We adjusted our direction like two boats in fog. Until, at a certain point, I realized that the light was changing. Now it was casting shadows on the rocks in front of me. I looked up and saw a blue tone in the flurries of increasingly sparse fog, and after a few more steps, I was through it. All at once, I found myself looking around in full sunlight, with the September sky above my head and the dense white of the clouds beneath my feet. We were well above 2,500 meters. Only a few peaks emerged at that height, like chains of islands, like surfacing dorsals. I also saw that we had deviated from the proper route to the Grenon summit, or at least from the usual one. But instead of crossing the scree at the fork, I decided to reach the crest by climbing what was immediately above me. It didn't look difficult. As I climbed, I fantasized about achieving a first, something that would be recorded in the annals of the Italian Alpine Club, together with the author of such a feat, Northwest Crest of the Grenon, Pietro Guasti, 2008. But just a little further up, on a ledge, I found a few rusty meat or sardine tins of the kind that many years ago no one bothered to take back with them to the valley. So I discovered once again that someone had preceded me. There was a gorge between where I was and the usual route, getting steeper and steeper up to the crest. Bruno had taken it, and on its steep slope I saw that he had developed a peculiar style of his own. He used his hands as well and climbed on all fours rapidly, instinctively choosing the right places for his hands and feet, and never putting his whole weight on them. Sometimes the ground would give way beneath his feet or hands, but his momentum had carried him forward, and the small cascades of stones that he dislodged continued on down like memories of his passing through there. Homo Serrazzo, the wild man, I thought. Having got to the top before him, I had time to admire this new style of his from the crest. "Who taught you to climb like that?" I asked. "The chamois. I watched them once and said to myself, 'Now I'm going to try it like that too.'" "And it works?" "Well, I've still got a few improvements to make."
"Did you know that we would get above the clouds?"
"I was hoping that we would."
We sat down, leaning against the pile of stones where I had once found words written by my father. The sun was sculpting every edge and indentation in the rock, and doing the same to Bruno's face. He had new crow's feet around his eyes, shadows under his cheekbones, furrows that I did not recall him having before. His first season at the farmstead must have been hard going. It seemed like the right moment to talk to him about my journey. I told him that in Milan I had secured enough funding to stay away for at least a year. I wanted to go around the regions of Nepal and portray the people that lived in its mountains. There were so many different groups in the valleys of the Himalayas, all distinct from each other. I would be leaving in October, near the end of the monsoon season. I had little money, but many contacts, people working there who would be able to help me and put me up. I confided that I had given up my home in Turin, that I didn't have another one there now, and neither did I want one. If things went well in Nepal, I would stay there even longer. Bruno listened in silence. When I had finished speaking, he took a while to reflect on the implications of what I had told him. He was looking at Monte Rosa and said, "Do you remember that time with your father?" "Of course I remember. I think about it sometimes, you know. Do you think the ice of that day has reached the bottom yet?" "I don't think so. It's probably about halfway." Then he asked, "Are the Himalayas like our region at all?" "No," I replied. "Not at all." It was not easy to explain, but I wanted to try, so I added, "You know those enormous ruined monuments like the ones in Athens and Rome? Those ancient temples of which only a few columns are left standing, with the stones of their walls lying scattered about on the ground? Well, the Himalayas are like the original temple. It's like being able to see it intact after having spent a lifetime only ever seeing ruins." I immediately regretted having spoken in this way. Bruno was gazing at the glaciers above the clouds, and I thought that in the coming months I would remember him like this, like the custodian of that pile of rubble. Then he got up. "Time to do the milking," he said. "Are you coming down?" "I think I'll stay here a bit longer." "Good for you. Who would want to go back down below?" He entered the gorge up which he'd climbed and disappeared amongst the rocks. I caught sight of him again a few minutes later, about 100 meters further down. There was a spit of snow down there, pushed northwards, and he had crossed the scree in order to reach it. From above that small snowfield, he tested its consistency with his foot. He looked up in my direction and waved, and I responded with a big gesture that might be seen from a distance. The snow must have been well frozen because Bruno jumped on it and immediately picked up speed. He went down with his legs spread out, skiing with his work boots, waving his arms to keep his balance, and in an instant was swallowed up by the fog. 11. Anita was born in the autumn, like all mountain folk. I was not there that year. In Nepal, I had come into contact with the world of NGOs and was working with a group of them. I was filming documentaries in the villages where schools and hospitals were being built, agricultural projects or employment initiatives for women were being developed, and where sometimes camps for Tibetan refugees were being set up. I didn't like everything that I was seeing. The managers in Kathmandu were no more than careerist politicians. But in the mountains themselves, I came across people of every sort, from old hippies to students doing VSO, from volunteer medics to mountaineers who between one expedition and another would stay on to work as builders. Not even these examples of humanity were entirely free from ambition and power struggles. But what they did not lack was idealism, and I liked being among idealists. I was in Mustang in June, an arid plateau on the border with Tibet made up of small white houses clinging to the red rock, when my mother wrote to let me know that she had just gone up to Grana and discovered that Laura was 5 months pregnant. She felt immediately called to do her duty. Throughout the summer, she sent me updates that resembled medical reports. In June, Laura had twisted her ankle while she was out in the pasture and had continued to hobble around for days. In July, with her very pale skin, she suffered sunstroke while making hay. In August, with backache and swollen legs, she still carried down the cheese twice a week with the mule. My mother would order her to rest. Laura would not hear of it. When Bruno suggested that they should hire someone to do her work, she refused, saying that the cows were all pregnant too and that no one made a fuss about it. That seeing them so calm actually helped her to relax. I had come to Kathmandu at the height of the monsoon season. Every afternoon the city was whipped by a storm. Then the crazy traffic of motorbikes and bicycles would cease. The packs of street dogs would seek refuge under overhanging roofs. The streets themselves became rivers of mud and rubbish, and I would shut myself in some place or other with a phone line, in front of an ancient computer, and catch up on the latest news. I did not know whether to admire Laura most, expecting her first child in an alpeggio, or that other woman, now 70 years old, who would climb up to visit her on foot and accompany her to the hospital each month. The August scan established beyond doubt that Laura was expecting a girl. Even now she continued to pasture the cows, with a belly so big that it prevented any movement except simply walking in front of the herd and sitting under a tree to watch over it. Then, on the last Sunday of September, with their hides brushed and shining, their embroidered leather collars and their ceremonial bells, the cows went down to the valley in a solemn end-of-season procession. Bruno installed them in the stable he had rented for the winter, and at that point there was nothing left to do but wait. He must have done a certain amount of calculation, in true mountain man style, because Laura gave birth soon after, as if that too was seasonal work. I remember where I was when my mother gave me the news. In Lower Dolpo, on the shore of a lake that uncannily resembled an alpine one, surrounded by woods of red fir and Buddhist temples, together with a girl that I had met in Kathmandu. She worked at an orphanage in the city, but at that time we had taken a few days off and headed for the mountains together, in a refuge without a stove at 3,500 meters, the walls of which were nothing more than small shingles painted blue. We had put together our two sleeping bags and huddled inside. Through the window I looked out at the star-studded sky and the pointed tops of the fir trees as she slept. At a certain point I saw the moon rise. I stayed awake a long time, thinking about my friend Bruno, who had just become a father. When I returned to Italy in 2010, I found it deep in a grotesque economic crisis. Milan announced it to me on arrival, with its airport looking virtually decommissioned. 4 planes on kilometers of runway, and the window displays of the high fashion brands glistening in the empty shops. From the train that took me to the city, freezing from the air conditioning on a July evening, I noticed building sites everywhere, tall cranes suspended, high-rise buildings with bizarre profiles that were taking shape on the horizon. I could not understand why all the newspapers were talking about all the money having run out when I was noticing in Milan, and also in Turin, a building boom that resembled that of a golden age. Going in search of old friends was like doing a tour of hospital wards. The production companies, the advertising agencies, and the television channels that I had worked for were shutting down due to bankruptcy, and many of those friends were at home on their sofas doing nothing. Nearing 40, they were reduced to taking the odd day's work and to accepting money from their retired parents. "But look outside," one of them said to me. "Do you see the buildings sprouting up everywhere? Who is it that's stealing what was due to us?" Wherever I went, I breathed in this air of disillusionment and anger, this intergenerational sense of grievance. It was a relief to have in my pocket already the ticket with which I would be able to leave. A few days later, I took a coach to the mountains, then another at the beginning of the valley, and got off at the bar where I used to go with my mother to make calls, though there was no longer any trace there of the red phone box. I followed the path on foot, just as before. The old mule track cut through the bends of the asphalted road and soon became choked with brambles and leaves, so rather than follow it, I went up through the woods, relying on my memory of the way. When I came out on the other side, I discovered that next to the ruins of the tower, a mobile phone mast had gone up, and that down in the gully a cement dam interrupted the flow of the river. The little artificial reservoir was full of mud from the thaw. An excavator was fishing it out of the water and dumping it on the bank, destroying with its caterpillar tracks and the muddy sand the meadows where Bruno used to graze cattle as a boy. Then, as always, I got beyond Grana, and it seemed like I was leaving every poisoned thing behind me. It was like entering the sacred valley when going to Annapurna, except that here it was not any religious precept, but simply neglect that had left everything unchanged. I discovered again the clearing that as children Bruno and I called the sawmill, because 2 tracks remained there together with a trolley used who knows how long ago for cutting planks of wood for buildings. Nearby there was a cable lift for dispatching those planks up to the Alpeggi. The steel cable wound around a larch tree that with the passage of time had engulfed it in bark. They had forgotten my childhood mountain because it wasn't worth anything, and it was fortunate in this respect. I slowed down like the Nepalese porters who would whisper at high altitude, "Pistare, pistare." I did not want these moments to be over too soon. Every time I went back up there, I felt like I was returning to my own self, to the place where I was most like myself again and felt best. At the farmstead, they were expecting me for lunch. Bruno, Lara, the little Anita, who at less than a year old, was playing on a blanket in the middle of a meadow, and my mother, who did not take her eyes off her for a moment. She said, "It's your Uncle Pietro, Anita, look," and immediately brought her to me to get acquainted. The little girl looked at me with suspicion, intrigued by my beard. She tugged it, and making a sound that I didn't catch, started laughing at her new discovery. My mother seemed quite different from the aging woman I had said goodbye to when I left. Other things had altered, too. The whole farmstead was livelier than I remembered it. The new chickens and rabbits, the mule, the cows, the dogs, a fire on which the polenta and a stew were cooking, the table laid in the open air. Bruno was so pleased to see me again that he embraced me. It was a gesture so unusual between us that as he squeezed me I wondered how much he might have changed. When we separated, I looked hard at his face, searching for wrinkles, gray hairs, the heaviness of age in his features. I had the impression that he was looking for the same in mine. Were we still the same? Then he sat me down at the head of the table and poured the drinks, four glasses brimming with red wine with which to toast my return. I was no longer used to wine or meat, and soon felt intoxicated by both. I was speaking nonstop. Lara and my mother took turns to get up and look after Anita, until the little girl began to feel sleepy and there was a sign, I think, or a silent understanding between them, and my mother gathered her up in her arms and moved away, cradling her. I had brought back as a gift a teapot, cups, and a packet of black tea, so after lunch I made some, Tibetan style, with butter and salt, even if the alpine butter was not as strong or rancid as butter made from yak's milk. While I was mixing it, I told them that in Tibet they used butter in every way imaginable. They burned it in lamps, spread it as a moisturizer on women's hair, mixed it with human bones in sky burials.
"What?" said Bruno.
I explained that on the high plateaus there wasn't enough wood to cremate corpses. The dead were flayed and left on top of a hill so that the vultures would devour them. After a few days, they would return to find the bones picked clean. The skull and the skeleton were then pounded up and mixed with butter and flour, so that this too would become food for the birds.
"How horrible," Lara said. "But why?" said Bruno.
"Can you imagine it? The dead person there on the ground and the vultures eating them piece by piece?"
"Well, being put in a hole in the ground is not so very different," I said. "Something will end up eating you there as well."
"Yes, but at least you don't have to see it," Lara said.
"I think it's a great idea," said Bruno. "Food for the birds."
On the other hand, he was disgusted by the tea, and emptied our cups as well as his own before filling them with grappa instead. The three of us were all a little drunk by now. He put his arm around Lara's shoulders and said,
"And what about the Himalayan girls? Are they as beautiful as those in the Alps?"
I became serious without meaning to, and mumbled something in reply.
"You're not turning into some kind of Buddhist monk, are you?"
But Lara had picked up on the meaning of my reticence, and answered for me. "No, no. There is someone who is keeping him company." Then Bruno looked at my face and smiled, seeing there that it was true, and I instinctively looked over to where my mother was, too far off to hear what we were saying. Later on, I went to lie down beneath an old larch, a solitary tree that dominated the meadows above the house. I remained stretched out there with my eyes half closed and my hands behind my head, looking at the summits and the ridges of the Grenon through the branches and surrendering to sleep. That view always reminded me of my father. I thought that in some way, without knowing it, this strange family amongst which I had found myself had been founded by him. Who knows what he would have made of it, seeing us all together at that lunch? His wife, his son, his other son from the mountains, a young woman and a little girl. If we had really been brothers, I thought, Bruno could be nothing other than the eldest. He was the one who made things, the builder of houses, a family, a business, the firstborn with his land, his livestock, his offspring. I was the younger brother, the squanderer, the one who does not get married, does not have children, and who travels the world without sending news for months at a time, turning up out of the blue on the day of a party, just as lunch is about to be served. Who would have thought that, eh, Dad? Immersed in these alcohol-induced musings, I fell asleep in the sun.
I spent a few weeks with them that summer. Not long enough to stop feeling that I was only visiting, but too long to just sit around doing nothing. Up at Barma, my 2-year absence had left its mark. So much so, in fact, that when I saw the house again, I felt like apologizing. The invasive vegetation had already begun to lay siege to her. Certain roof tiles were warped or out of place. And when I left, I had forgotten to remove the piece of chimney flue that stuck out of the wall, so that the snow had broken it and caused some damage inside the house as well. It would have taken only a few more years for the mountain to reclaim her, and to reduce her again to the pile of rubble that she was before. I decided to devote my remaining time there to the house, preparing her for my next departure. Spending time with Bruno and Laura, I discovered that something else had begun to deteriorate while I was away. When my mother was not there and Anita had been put to bed, the place changed from being a happy farmstead to being a business that was in the red, and my friends became squabbling financial partners. Laura talked about nothing else. She told me that the sums they made from cheesemaking did not even cover the mortgage repayments. The money came and went, leaving them with nothing to spare, and making no inroad on their debt with the bank. Living up there in the summer, they were able to be almost self-sufficient. But in the winter, what with the rent for the stables and other costs, they were really struggling. They had needed to take out another loan, new debts with which to pay for old. That summer, Laura had decided to cut out the middleman, bypassing the distributor that I had met and selling directly to shopkeepers, even though it meant a load more work for her. Twice every week, she would leave the little girl with my mother and Grana, and go by car to make deliveries, leaving Bruno to manage on his own. They should have taken someone on, but this would have put them back where they started again. He would start fuming soon after she began telling me about these things. One evening, he said, "Can't we change the subject? We hardly ever see Pietro. Do we always have to be talking about money?" Laura took offense. "So what should we be talking about?" she said. "Let's see, what about yaks? What do you think, Pietro? Could we set up a nice business breeding yaks?" "It's not such a bad idea," Bruno said. "Listen to him," Laura said to me. "Living up here on the mountain with his head in the clouds, he doesn't have any of the problems of us mere mortals. And then to him, but remember that it's you who got us into this mess, right?" "That's right," said Bruno. "They're my debts. You shouldn't take them too much to heart." Hearing that, she glared at him furiously, got up abruptly, and left. He immediately regretted having uttered such words. "She's right," he said. "But what can I do? I can't work any harder than I am already, and thinking about money all the time solves nothing, so it's preferable to think about something else, isn't it?" "But how much do you need?" I asked. "Forget it. If I told you, you'd be shocked." "Perhaps I can help. Perhaps I can stay here and work until the end of the season." "Thanks, but no." "You wouldn't have to pay me, of course. I'd be only too pleased to help." "No," said Bruno curtly. In the days that were left before my departure, we did not mention the subject again. Laura kept to herself, offended, worried, busying herself around the little girl. Bruno pretended that nothing had happened. I would go up and down from Grana with the materials I needed to fix the house. I had reapplied cement where it was needed, stopped up the chimney flue, cleared the weeds from the surrounding land. I'd had larch tiles cut similar to the old ones, and was on the roof replacing them when Bruno arrived to see me. Perhaps he had intended us to go up the mountain together, but finding me on the roof changed his mind, and he climbed up to join me there instead. It was a job that we had already done. 6 years ago now. We quickly found our old rhythm. Bruno removed the old nails and I threw them down onto the grass. Then I put the new tile into place and held it firm while he hammered it down. There was no need to say anything. For an hour it seemed as if we had gone back to that summer, when our lives still had direction and we had nothing to worry about other than building a wall or raising a beam. It was over too quickly. In the end, the roof was like new, and I went to the fountain to get 2 beers that I kept cold there in its icy water. That morning I had taken down the prayer flags, faded by the sun and rain and torn by the wind, and had burned them in the stove. Then I hung up some new ones, stringing them this time between the rock face and a corner of the house rather than between trees, thinking about the stupas that I had seen in Nepal. Now they were dancing in the wind above my father's epitaph, seeming to be blessing him. Bruno was watching them when I went back onto the roof.
"What's written on those things?" he asked.
"They're prayers asking for good fortune," I said. "Prosperity, peace, harmony."
"And do you believe in that?"
"In what? Good fortune?"
"No, in praying."
"I don't know, but they put me in a good mood, and that's enough, no?"
"Yes, you're right."
I was reminded of our own good luck charm, and looked to see how it was getting on. The little Swiss pine was still there, as delicate and contorted as the day when it was transplanted, but still alive. By now it was heading towards its seventh winter. It too was swaying in the wind, but inspired neither peace nor harmony. Tenacity, if anything, a clinging on to life. I thought that in Nepal these were not virtues, but that in the Alps, perhaps, they were. I opened the beers. Handing one to Bruno, I asked,
"So how's it going, being a father?"
"How's it going? I'd like to know the answer to that myself."
He raised his eyes to the sky and then added,
"For now, it's easy. I carry her in my arms and stroke her as if she were a little rabbit or a kitten. That I know how to do. I've always done it. The difficulty will come when I have to tell her about things."
"But why?
What do I know about anything? In my life, I've only ever known this."
When he said this, he made a gesture with his hand to encompass the lake, the woods, the meadows, and the scree that we had in front of us. I did not know if he had ever gone away from there, or if he had, how far. I had never even asked, partly in order not to offend him, partly because the answer would not have changed anything. He said,
"I know how to milk a cow, how to make cheese, to cut down a tree, to build a house. I would also know how to shoot an animal and eat it if I was starving. I've been taught these things since I was little. But who teaches you how to be a father? Not my own father, that's for sure. In the end, I had to beat him up so that he would leave me alone. Have I ever told you about that?"
"No," I said.
"Well, that's what happened. I was working all day on the building site. I was stronger than him. I think I must have really hurt him because I haven't seen him since. The poor bastard."
He looked up at the sky again. The same wind that was agitating my prayer flags was pushing the clouds over the ridges. He said,
"I'm only glad that Anita's a girl, so I can just love her, and that's that."
I had never seen him so low. Things had not gone as he had hoped. I had the same sense of powerlessness as when we were boys, and he would not utter a word for an entire day, plunged into a despondency that seemed absolute and irredeemable. I would like to have had some old friend's trick with which to raise his spirits. Before he left, the legend of the eight mountains came to my mind, and I thought that he might like to hear it. Relating it to him, I tried to remember every word and gesture with which the chicken carrier had given it to me. With a nail, I scratched the mandala on a wooden tile.
"So you're supposed to be the one who journeys to the eight mountains, and I'm the one who climbs Sumeru?"
"It looks like it."
"And which one of us achieves something good?"
"It's you," I said, not just to encourage him, but because I believed it. Bruno said nothing. He looked at the drawing again in order to memorize it. Then he gave me a pat on the back and jumped down from the roof. Without having in any way planned it, I too found myself caring for children in Nepal. Not in the mountains, but on the periphery of Kathmandu, a city that now sprawled across its entire valley with outskirts resembling the shanty towns to be found in so many other parts of the world. They were the children of people who had come to the city seeking their fortune. Some had lost one of their parents, some had lost both. But more often than not, the father or mother lived in a shack and worked like a slave in that ant's nest, leaving them to be raised on the streets. These children had been dealt a fate that did not exist in the mountains. In Kathmandu, the child beggars, the small gangs dedicated to some kind of trafficking or other, and the dirty, stupefied kids who scavenged through the city's rubbish, were as familiar a part of the urban landscape as street dogs and the monkeys in the Buddhist temples. There were organizations that were trying to care for them, and the girl I was with was working for one of these.
Given what I was seeing for myself on the streets and hearing about it from her, it was inevitable that I would begin to lend a hand, too. You find your place in the world much less predictably than you'd imagine. Here I was, after so much wandering, in a big city at the foot of the mountains, with a woman who was basically doing the same work as my mother did, and with whom, at every opportunity, I would escape to altitude in order to replenish the energy sapped by the city. Walking these paths, I thought often about Bruno. It wasn't the woods or the rivers so much as the children that reminded me of him. I remembered him at their age, growing up in what remained of his dying village, with ruins as his only playground and a school that had been turned into a storehouse. There was a lot to be doing in Nepal for someone with his skills. We taught the migrant children English and maths from textbooks, but perhaps what we should have been showing them was how to cultivate a plot, how to build a stable, raise goats. And so I would sometimes fantasize about dragging Bruno away from his dying mountain to help teach these other mountain folk. We could have done great things together in this part of the world. And yet, if it had just been down to us, we would not have contacted each other for years, as though our friendship had no need of being kept up. It was my mother who gave us news of each other, since she was all too familiar with living with men who did not communicate amongst themselves. She wrote to me about Anita, about the character that she was developing, about the way in which she was growing up wild and fearless. She had become very attached to this little girl, and it worried her to see the crisis between her parents worsening. They worked too hard, and continued to find ways of working even harder. So much so that in the summer my mother would frequently keep Anita with her at Grana, in order to free her parents from at least the burden of having to care for her too. Lara was exasperated by their deaths. Bruno had retreated into mutism and into his work. My mother did not mention directly what she feared, but it was not difficult to read between the lines. We had both begun to see how things would end up. They struggled on in this way for a little longer. Then in the autumn of 2013, Bruno declared himself bankrupt, shut down the agricultural business, and handed over the keys of the farm to the bailiff, and Laura went to live with her parents with the child. Although, according to my mother, things had happened the other way round. Laura had decided to leave him, and he had given up, resigning himself to failure. Either way, it made no difference. But the tone in which she conveyed the news was not just sad, but alarmed, and I could tell that she was afraid for what might happen to Bruno now. "He's lost everything," she wrote, "and he is all alone. Is there anything you can do?" I read these words several times before doing something that I had never done before in Nepal. I got up from the computer, asked to use the telephone, and went into a booth to dial the code for Italy and then Bruno's number. It was one of those places in Kathmandu where people seem permanently to be killing time. The owner was eating rice and lentils, an old man sitting next to him was watching him eat, and two children were peering into the booth at me to see what I was up to. The phone rang 5 or 6 times, at which point I began to think that Bruno would not answer it. Knowing him, he might have hurled the mobile into the woods and decided not to hear from anyone ever again. Instead, there was a click, a distant fumbling, and an uncertain voice that was saying, "Hello?" "Bruno," I shouted. "It's me, Pietro." On hearing my outburst of Italian, the boys burst out laughing. I pressed the receiver closer to my ear. The delay on the long-distance line added an extra hesitation. Then Bruno said, "Yes, I'd hoped it would be you." He did not feel like talking about what had happened with Laura. I could imagine, anyway, how it had been. I asked him how he was and what he planned to do. He replied, "I'm fine. I'm just tired. They took away the farm, did you hear?" "Yes. And what did you do with the cows?" "Oh, I gave them away." "And what about Anita?" "Anita is with Laura at her parents'. They've got plenty of room there. I've heard from them. They're doing fine." Then he added, "Listen, I wanted to ask you something." "Tell me." "If I can use the house up at Barma, since at the moment I don't really know where to go." "But do you really want to go up there?" "I don't want to see anyone. You know how it is. I'll spend some time in the mountains." That's how he said it. In the mountains. It was strange to hear his voice on a phone in Kathmandu. A voice that arrived there hoarse and so distorted that I struggled to recognize it, but that I knew at that moment was really his. It was Bruno, my old friend. I said, "Of course. Stay as long as you want. It's your house."
"Thanks."
There was something else I wanted to say, but it was difficult. We were not used to asking each other for help, or to offering it. Without beating around the bush, I asked, "Listen, would you like me to come over?" In the past, Bruno would have immediately told me to stay where I was. When he eventually answered, he did so with a tone of voice that I had never heard before, ironic in part, and partly disarmed. He said,
"Well, that would be nice.
I'll sort a few things out and then come, all right?"
"All right."
It was a late afternoon in November. As I left the place from which I'd phoned, darkness was falling over the city. In that part of the world, the streets are not lit, and at sunset people hurry home, and you sense an anxiety about night falling. Outside there were dogs, dust, scooters, a cow lying in the middle of the road stopping the traffic, tourists heading for restaurants and hotels, the air of an evening in late summer. In Grana, it was the beginning of winter, and it occurred to me that I had never before seen that season there. 12. The deep-cut valley of Grana in October was burnt by drought and frost. It had the color of ochre, of sand, of terracotta, and looked as if its meadows had been burnt in a fire now spent. In its woods, that fire was still ablaze. On the flanks of the mountain, the gold and bronze flames of the larches were lit against the dark green of the pines, and raising your eyes to the sky warmed the soul. The sun no longer reached the bottom of the valley, and the earth was hard underfoot, covered here and there with a crust of frost. At the little wooden bridge, when I bent down to drink, I saw that the autumn had cast a spell over that river of mine. The ice was forming slides and galleries, draping the wet stones with glass, trapping tufts of dry grass and transforming them into found sculptures. Climbing towards Bruno's farmstead, I crossed paths with a group of hunters. They were wearing camouflage jackets and binoculars around their necks, but had no rifles. They did not seem like locals to me, but then perhaps in the autumn even faces change, and I was the outsider here. They were talking together in dialect, and when they saw me they stopped talking, sized me up with a glance, and continued on their way. I found out soon after where they had stationed themselves, up at the farmstead, near the bench where Bruno and I would sit of an evening. I found their cigarette butts and a crumpled, empty packet. They must have climbed up early in the morning in order to study the woods from that vantage point. Bruno had put everything in good order before leaving. He had sealed the stable door, closed the shutters, stacked the wood against the side of the house, overturned the drinking troughs along the wall. He had even spread the manure that was dry and odorless now in the yellowed meadows. It looked just like any other alpine farmstead prepared for the winter months. And I lingered a while, remembering how it was, full of noise and life, the last time that I had visited it. Breaking the silence, I heard a belling from the other side of the valley. I had only ever heard this sound a few times before, but once would have been enough to remember it forever. It was the powerful, guttural, angry sound with which the stag intimidates his rivals in the mating season, even though it was too late now for reproduction. Perhaps the stag was just plain angry, nothing more. At this point, I realized what those hunters had come looking for. Something similar happened a little while later, up at the lake. The sun was just managing to peer over the crests of the Grainon, warming the scree facing it at midday. But the inlet at the foot of the slope remained in shadow even at this hour. A layer of ice had formed on the water, a half-moon that was polished and dark. When I tested it with a stick, the ice was so thin that it broke. I took a piece of it from the water and held it up to look through, and at that moment I heard a chainsaw starting up. The revving of the motor, and then the squeal of the blade biting wood. I looked to see where it was coming from. There was a copse of larch midway up the slope, just above Barma, growing on a kind of small terrace. The naked, gray trunk of a dead tree stuck out amongst the yellow tresses of the others. I heard the chainsaw cutting into the wood, twice. Then the pause required to walk around the tree, then again the screech of the blade as it bit into the wood. I saw it slowly begin to topple before it suddenly collapsed, with a crackling rush of branches splitting as it fell. What can I tell you, Pietro? Things went badly, Bruno said that evening, then shrugged his shoulders to indicate that he had nothing more to add on the subject.
He was drinking coffee, reheated on the stove, and looking out to where it was getting dark already at 5 o'clock. We were using candles in the house now that our little mill wheel was stopped due to drought. I had seen 2 full packs of white candles in the other room, together with the stacks of cornmeal, a couple of loaves of cheese remaining from the last batch made, a reserve of tins, some potatoes, and cartons of wine. It was not the larder of someone who was in any hurry to go back down. During the month since our phone call, Bruno had laid in supplies and elaborated his own kind of mourning. The farm had gone badly, the relationship with Lara had gone badly, and he spoke about these things, or rather avoided speaking about them, as if they belonged to some remote period in both time and thought. Rather than remember them, he seemed to want to forget about them entirely. We spent these days making firewood for the winter. In the morning, we would study a slope in search of a dead tree, climb up to cut it down, divest it of its branches before Bruno took off its top with the chainsaw, then would spend hours laboring to shift it to the house. We would tie a strong rope around it and drag it down by sheer force of our own strength. We had built slides throughout the wood, using old planks like sleepers, with banks of piled branches positioned where the trunk was in danger of slipping from our grasp with the steepness of the slope. But sooner or later it would get entangled with some obstacle or other, and then the work of dislodging it from there would begin. Bruno would curse it. He handled a pickaxe as if it were one of those small hoes lumberjacks use, levering up the trunk so that it could be pivoted halfway round. He would try one side and then the other, swearing as he did so, before flinging the tool to the ground and going to pick up the chainsaw again. I had always admired his way of working, the grace that he was able to express when using any kind of tool. But all trace of that was gone now. He would wield the chainsaw furiously, stall it, over-rev it, and when sometimes he had used up its petrol, he would be on the verge of flinging it away as well. He would end up solving the problem by cutting the trunk into pieces and giving us another one instead, multiple journeys carrying them back to the house. Then we would set to splitting the wood with a sledgehammer and wedges until nightfall. The strokes of iron upon iron reverberated around the mountainside, drier, shriller, meaner when Bruno was hammering, more uncertain and discordant when I took my turn. Until the master stroke came, the trunk split, and we finished the job with the axe. The snow was already sparse on the Grainon. What little there was allowed the scree in the bushes, the ledges, and the outcrops of rock to be made out still, as if the snowfall were no more than a thin layer of frost. But towards the end of the month, a cold front arrived, the temperature dropped suddenly, and the lake froze over in the course of one night. The next morning I went down to look. The ice near the shore was rendered grayish and opaque by a myriad of trapped air bubbles, and became gradually darker and then blacker the further away you went from it. With a stick, I could not even dent it, so I decided to risk walking on it to see if it would take my weight. I had only taken a few steps before I heard a rumbling from deep in the lake that made me retreat immediately. Safely on the shore, I heard it again, an ominous rumbling, resounding like a bass drum being hit over and over, extremely slowly and rhythmically, perhaps once every minute, perhaps even slower. It could not be anything other than water, beating against the ice from below. With the coming of daylight, the water seemed to want to break out of the tomb in which it had found itself encased. At sunset, our endless evenings began. The horizon at the end of the valley would be tinged red for barely a few minutes before darkness fell. From then until it was time to sleep, the light did not change again. It could be 6, 7, 8, and we would be spending the hours in front of the stove in silence, each with a candle to read by, the glow of the fire, the wine rationed to make it last, the one luxury at our suppers. During those days I cooked potatoes in every conceivable way, boiled, roasted, grilled, fried in butter, baked with melted toma, with the candle next to the hot plate to see when they were done. We would eat them in 10 minutes, then face each other for another 2 or 3 hours of silent vigil. The fact was that I was waiting for something, I didn't know what. Something that wasn't happening. I had come back from Nepal to rescue my friend, and now my friend seemed to have no need of me.
If I asked him a question, he would let it drop with one of those vague responses that extinguished from the start any potential glimmer of conversation. He could spend an hour staring at the fire. And only occasionally, when I'd given up expecting him to, he spoke. But as if already mid-sentence, or as if he were temporarily following out loud the train of his own thoughts. One evening, he said, "I was there once, in Milan." "Oh, really?" I said. "But it was a long time ago. I must have been 20. One day I had an argument with my boss and walked off the site. I had a whole afternoon free, so I said to myself, 'Right, I'll go there now.' I took the car, went to the motorway, and arrived in the evening. I wanted to have a beer in Milan. I stopped at the first bar and had one. Then I headed back."
"And what did you think of Milan?"
"Not much. Too many people." And then he added, "And I've also been to the sea. I went to Genoa once and saw it. I had a blanket in the car and slept there. Nobody was waiting for me at home anyway."
"And what was the sea like?"
"A big lake."
His accounts of things were like this. They might or might not have been true, and they went nowhere. Only once, out of the blue, he said,
"It was great, wasn't it, when we used to sit in front of the stable in the evening?"
I put down the book I was reading and responded, "Yes, really great." The way night fell in July, the calm descended, do you remember? It was the hour I liked best, and then when I got up to milk the cows, it was still dark. The two of them were still sleeping, and I felt as if I were watching over everything, as if they could sleep peacefully because I was there. Then he added, "It's stupid, no? But that's how I felt."
"I don't see anything stupid about it."
"It's stupid because no one can look after anyone else. It's hard enough to look after yourself. Men are designed to always cope if they're clever. But if they think they're too clever, they end up being ruined."
"Is starting a family being too clever?"
"Perhaps it is, for some."
"Well, perhaps some should think twice before bringing children into the world."
"Yes, you're right," Bruno said. I stared at him in the semi-darkness, trying to understand what was going through his mind. One half of his face was yellowed by the light from the stove, the other completely dark.
"So what are you saying?" I asked. He stared at the fire as if I were no longer even there.
I felt an increasing impatience that drove me outside into the dark, craving a cigarette for company. I stayed outside, looking for the stars that were not visible, and asking myself what I was doing back here, until I realized that my teeth were chattering. Then I went back into the warm, dark, smoky room. Bruno had not moved. I warmed my feet in front of the stove, then went up to shut myself into my sleeping bag. The next morning, I was the first to get up. In the light of day, I did not feel like sharing that small room, so skipped coffee and went out for a walk. I went down to look at the lake and found it covered by an overnight frost that the wind was sweeping here and there, lifting it in flurries, puffs, and miniature whirlwinds that appeared and disappeared in an instant, like restless spirits. Beneath the frost, the ice was black and looked like stone. As I stood there looking at it, a shot echoed in the valley, rebounding from one side to the other so that it was difficult to tell whether it came from below in the woods or from the crests above. But I instinctively looked upwards for its origin, scouring the scree and the slopes for any sign of movement. When I got back to Barma, I saw that two hunters had come to speak to Bruno. They had modern weapons with telescopic sights. At one point, one of the two opened his rucksack and deposited a black bag at Bruno's feet. The other one noticed my presence and nodded in my direction. And recognizing something familiar about that gesture, I realized soon enough who they were. The two cousins from whom Bruno had bought the farmstead. I had not seen them for more than 25 years. I had not known that he was in touch with them, nor how they had found him up there. But who knows how much else there was about Grana that I could not even imagine. From out of the black bag, after they had gone, a dead and already gutted chamois emerged. When Bruno hung it up by its back legs from the branch of a larch tree, I could see that it was a female. It had its dark winter coat with a thick black line down the middle of its back, a slender neck from which its lifeless muzzle dangled, two small horns that looked like hooks. From the gash in its belly, the steam was still rising in the cold morning air. Bruno went inside to fetch a knife and sharpened it carefully before setting to work. Then he was as precise and methodical as if he had spent a lifetime doing nothing but this. He made an incision in the skin around the shins and continued along the inside of the thighs, all the way down to the groin where the two cuts joined. He went back up, detached a flap of skin from the shin, put down the knife and grasped the flap with both hands, tugging it down violently to expose first one thigh and then the other. Under the skin, there was a white, viscous layer, the fat that the chamois had put on for the winter months, and beneath the fat you could glimpse the pink of its flesh. Bruno took the knife again, made a cut in the breast and another two in the front legs, grasped again the flayed hide that was now hanging halfway down its back, and tugged it hard. You need some strength to tear hide from flesh, but he used more force than was necessary, putting into it the anger that he had kept bottled up ever since I had arrived. The skin came off in one piece, like a dress. Then he grabbed hold of one of the horns with his left hand, fumbled with his knife between the vertebrae of its neck, and I heard the crack of fractured bone. The head came off with the hide, and Bruno stretched it on the ground, with the fur lying on the grass and the skin facing upwards. The chamois looked much smaller now. Skinned and decapitated, it no longer even looked like a chamois. Just meat, bones, cartilage. Like one of those refrigerated carcasses hanging in cold storage in supermarkets. Bruno inserted his hands into the thorax and tore out the heart and lungs, then turned the carcass around. He felt with his fingers to find the veins of the muscles along the backbone, severed them with a light cut, and then went back over the line he had followed, plunging the knife in. The flesh that was disclosed then was of a dark red color. He cut off two long cords, dark and bloody. His arms were daubed with blood now, too. I'd had enough, and did not stay to witness the rest of the butchery. I just saw at the end the skeleton of the chamois hanging from the branch of the tree, reduced to next to nothing. A few hours later, I told him that I was leaving. At the table, I had tried to resume our conversation from the day before, this time being more direct. I asked him what he intended to do about Anita, what arrangements he had made with Laura, and whether he intended to visit them at Christmas.
"Probably not at Christmas," he answered.
"So when?"
"I don't know, maybe in the spring."
"Or maybe in the summer, right?"
"Listen, what difference does it make? It's better that she stays with her mother, isn't it? Or do you want me to bring her up here to live this kind of life with me?"
He said here just as he'd always done, as if at the bottom of his valley there was an invisible border, a wall erected only for him, preventing access to the rest of the world. "Perhaps you should go down," I said. "Maybe you're the one who needs to change your way of life."
"Me?" said Bruno. "But Berio, don't you remember who I am?"
Yes, I remembered. He was the cowherd, the bricklayer, the man of the mountains. And above all, he was his father's son. Just like him, he would disappear from the life of his child, and that was it. I looked at the plate in front of me. Bruno had prepared a hunter's delicacy, the heart and lungs of the chamois cooked with wine and onions, but I had barely touched it.
"You're not eating?" he asked, disappointed.
"It's too strong for me," I replied. I pushed the plate away and added, "Today I'm going down. I've got a few work-related things to sort out. Perhaps I'll come back to say goodbye before leaving."
"Yes, of course," said Bruno, without looking at me.
He didn't believe it, and neither did I. He took my plate, opened the door, and threw its contents outside for the crows and foxes, creatures with less delicate stomachs than mine. In December, I decided to go and visit Laura. I made my way up the valley as the snow was beginning to fall, at the start of the ski season. The landscape was not so very different from that of Grana, and while driving, it occurred to me that to a certain extent all mountains look the same, except that here there was nothing to remind me of myself or of someone I once loved, and that made all the difference. The way in which a place can be a custodian of your history, how you could read it there every time you went back. There could only be one mountain of this kind in anyone's lifetime, and in comparison with that one, all the others were merely minor peaks, even if they happened to be in the Himalayas.
There was a small ski resort at the head of the valley, two or three businesses in all, of the kind that were struggling to survive.